Hey Niall, welcome back to In Your Nature podcast. Here we are with another episode.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you to everybody for all the lovely feedback you've been giving us on our new season. It's really nice to know that people out there are listening to us and enjoying what we're bringing you. Thank you very much for that. And just to start, as we always do, by saying the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Leash and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, and is edited by Kieran O'Connor.
It's our second episode of the new season, and yeah, we're here. We are face to face again in the Birdwatch Ireland Library, and there's a bit of a link from the Birdwatch Ireland Library, and the subject of this conversation is that it's full of spiders and and old books, and spiders seem to love old books. I'm delighted with today. We're interviewing Colly Ennis, the Spider Man, on the subject of spiders.
Yes, I know there might be some arachnophobes out there who aren't so happy to hear this. Maybe you tuned in expecting it to be all about birds. We'll be a bit of birds later, and spiders and birds are of course connected, but spiders are all around us. They're a very important part of our ecosystem. They play a very key role as apex predators in their own ecosystems and their own habitats, and as bird food as well. So I think that it's really, really good that we're talking about them. And of course, over the course of the podcast in the future, we're going to expand to lots of other different types of attacks as well, not just the birds. You can't just protect birds in isolation, I always say. You have to protect all of the creatures and the flora and fauna that they depend on as well.
Absolutely. So, without further ado, I started off by asking Colly how he just got into spiders in the first place and found himself being the national expert and regular sort of late contributor and all that sort of stuff. I mean, he's really, really well known, and he's been flying the flag for arachnids and amphibians and all sorts in this country for ages now. So it was wonderful to talk to him. And over we go and hear what he has to say. So I'm here with the co-host of the Critter Shed podcast, science officer with the Herpetological Society of Ireland and zoology research associate in Trinity College. So big CV, big personality, a hero of mine, and all around sort of Spider-Man, nature hero, excellent science communicator, and all around nature man. And it's Colly Ennis. Colly, welcome to In Your Nature podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great. And ever since we sort of started it, it was a goal of ours to get you on. And we wanted to widen out the sort of spec of what we talk about on the podcast and get some great sort of nature heroes like yourself on and talk about what you guys know about best. So, yeah, spiders is a bit off. It's a bit off track for us, but delighted to be talking about spiders today. So
yeah, the hard sell.
a bit of a tougher sell. So I suppose I better go right back to the origins. What is an arachnid and what is a spider? Are they the same thing? What's the story? Give us a bit of a classification lesson maybe.
Yeah, arachnids are one of the inverts, the group of inverts, and spiders are one of that that group, which includes everything from harvestmen to whiptail scorpions and the true scorpions themselves. So they're a broad family, but the spiders are the most successful of the arachnids, and that's mainly down to how they reproduce. They have a very clever way of reproducing it, as opposed to their scorpion cousins that kind of do it a different way, but we'll talk about that later on, I'm sure.
Cool. And sort of, I suppose, probably make it go back a step. I mean, how does a chap from Tala and end up being sort of a Steve Irwin of his age? What's going on there?
Oh, God. When I was a kid, like a lot of kids, and I'm sure you can relate to this, and anybody who's involved in nature, conservation, zoology, all that kind of stuff, when I was a kid, I was fascinated by creepy crawlies. It wasn't tanks and bivariums back then. It was your granny's biscuit tin with some holes punched in the top, and you put your slugs in there. And the next day, they'd have laid eggs, and that just sparked an interest with me. Frog spawn, spiders especially as well. All those kind of things that you find in and around your garden. And you know, back before we had the internet, we had libraries, and I would pick up books and just start kind of getting lost in that. And I just found it fascinating. And, you know, they're so different to us in every way imaginable. And they're so ancient. Like, they're around for hundreds of millions of years, long before the dinosaurs. And the probably be around long after we're gone. And I just, that window into a past world and perhaps a future world fascinates me.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously really caught your attention and it's sustained, which is amazing.
Yeah.
That's deadly. And so give me some context on spiders in a global context and an Irish context. And do we have loads of spiders compared to like Britain and Europe and America, or are we like pretty impoverished? Are we like, are we talking 20 species, 200 species?
Well, like a lot of our biodiversity, we're quite poor compared to even our neighbours in the UK. So we've just under 400, 390, 95 or something species. And that fluctuates because we will have new arrivals occasionally coming to our shores, particularly some of the more recent ones have made the press, but that fluctuates. Now if you look at the UK, they've doubled that nearly, so it's for a small stretch of water it really has big implications when it comes to diversity, and that's across the board in Ireland, I suppose, even with amphibians, mammals, all that kind of stuff. And birds, I'm sure as well. So we're not as we wouldn't have as many species as most places. And then when you get into the tropics, you're talking about crazy amounts of species and subspecies, and it's mind-boggling. And that's where the old field guides come in very handy when you're out there looking at them. But we do have some really charming little native species of spider, and enough to keep an arachnid fan quite busy.
So you mentioned earlier on about sort of how their unique natural history, or their life history, should we say. So give me an idea of the life history of a spider.
Well, I'll stick with what we kind of would know around our gardens. So they'd be the araneomorphs. So the spiders are split into three groups. And there's the two main groups, so would be the mygellomorphs and the araneomorphs. Mygellomorphs are basically the tarantulas, the big, long-lived kind of spiders. They live up to 40 years sometimes, and the araneomorphs are would include all our garden spiders and the small stuff you find around the house. And they're more or less, as a general rule, and I'm being very general here, they'd be annuals, so they'll kind of have a yearly life cycle. Some of them will have 2 years, 3 years, but it's basically a kind of a seasonal thing. And their life cycle, like your garden cross spiders that you'll find on your rose bushes at this time of year, the big fat females and the big orb webs, they'll have overwintered as spiderlings, as tiny little pinheads, tiny spiders, and then fattened up during the summer, mated, and then produce an egg sac. And the egg sac develops, hatches out, the babies overwinter, and the cycle starts again.
Okay, I understand that then. Okay,
have a lot of babies, so if you find your cellar spider and the cobwebs in your house, you might find like hundreds of babies. And that's purely down to two factors, really, because they're quite cannibalistic, and they're also a prey item for nearly everything, like birds, frogs, everything loves to eat spiders. So it's that numbers game that they'll kind of reproduce en masse to allow one or two to mature into adults and kick off again.
Cool. I seen a tweet you put out today about harvest men and true spiders. You sort of drew attention to the spider or true spider having an abdomen and a torso, which was interesting to me. We have an awful lot of what I would commonly call daddy long legs in our shower and around the like utility and stuff, but I don't think they're the harvest men.
No. So you'll know them. They're the cellar spiders, basically, and they have a very cool way of defending themselves. You go up to their web and try to touch them, they'll gyrate like mad, like a person going crazy at a disco after a few too many rum and cokes. But they kind of do this mad defensive gyration, and they love, hence their common name, the cellar spider. They love those damp areas like our showers and such.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And tell me, I always thought it was a lot of dead spiders lying around the place, but how often does a cellar spider molt? Because they seem to be what looks to me like a little dead spider. Yeah. It's got the legs and it's got, but actually you look closer, there's no spider there. It's just the case.
Yeah, so unlike us mammals, we're constantly shedding our skin. All the dust in your house is basically your skin, which grosses people out when you tell them it, but it is mainly, we're kind of always shedding our skin. But invertebrates, when they grow, they don't have that feature. What they do is they literally split their body open, and the spiders do that by basically digesting the inner old layer of skin on the inside of their exoskeleton, and then they'll pump all the blood that's in their body into the cephalothorax, which is basically the top of the abdomen, the head, for want of a better word, and that will pop open like the bonnet of a car. It just goes pop, and then the spider will draw themselves out. Now, if it's an araneomorph, it will hang by a web, by a piece of silk, and use gravity to pull itself out of its pump and pull itself out of the old skin.
And would you have an example of one of those species, common one?
They'd all do it. Every one of them will mature the same way.
Okay.
Like any of your garden spiders will do that kind of growth. And for the mygelomorphs with the tarantulas, you know, I get a lot of people who are kids who are kind of getting their first tarantula, and they freak out because they go in to look at it and it's on its back in the enclosure, and that's their way of popping out of their exoskeleton, so you can reassure people that it's not dead. It's very funny as well, because when they do shed their skin again, like you said, you'll have a perfect second spider almost in the thing, so you can have great fun with your work colleagues by popping a tarantula skin the toilet and see who freaks out. But that's how they grow. And it depends, really. They shed their skin an awful lot as young spiders, obviously, because they're growing fast, but then as adults, then maybe once a year, so
okay.
they don't have to do it as often.
That makes a lot of sense. Does that make them very vulnerable for a time when the exoskeleton hardens up?
Absolutely.
Like
absolutely,
days,
yeah.
Hours?
Well, it depends on the size of the spider, and again, it's species specific. So, you know, but they are vulnerable for anything up to like 15 minutes to like 15 hours, depending on the species of spider. So, yeah, it is one of those. And as a spider keeper, it's scary when you have like one of your older girls that,
yes,
you know, you become quite fond of them, obviously, and it's strenuous on them as well. So yeah, you always kind of watch them extra carefully when they're doing that.
Okay, yeah, I suppose there's obviously people will know about like black widows, and they'll have heard all these kind of and false widows and all that sort of story. Are all female spiders widows? Because do they not have a habit of eating their mate every time? Or is it just an attempted thing? Or is it like 99 times out of sort of 100?
Yeah, so sexual conflict is a massive thing in the spider world. It's a group of animals where the males are essentially genetic couriers. They're just there to mature and then to find a female. They will approach the web or the burrow or whatever she's doing. Like if it's a, you know, one of the raft spiders, it's the same thing except on water, and it's all to do with vibrations. So there'll be a tippy tap kind of a signal made to her, and she will either reciprocate and let him know she's willing to mate, or she may just instantly attack him. So you do see male spiders at this time of year kind of crawling around the floor with legs missing and half their face ripped off, and they still have that urge to breed because that's all they're programmed to do, and once they've done that, then they'll die. But it's quite, as I was saying earlier, compared to like, so you know, whip scorpions, true scorpions, a lot of the arachnid cousins of the spider, they reproduce by planting a sperm packet basically on the ground and gyrating and pulling the female over that sperm packet, and she'll collect it, and that's touch and go. It works sometimes and it doesn't work other times.
If the male survives passing on his genetic material, will he survive for another season, or does he just
die?
He just goes off and die anyway.
Yeah. So like the scorpion's reproduction, I'm just going to use them as an example because it's quite simple. They pull the female over the sperm packet and she'll collect it externally. What spiders have done, which makes them more successful, I think they're 45% of the arachnids in the world now are spiders. And it's down to this reproduction where the male actually produces a sperm web. So he'll spin this web and place his sperm on that web. And he has two devices on the side of his head called palps, pedipalps. And they're essentially like a turkey baster, like or an eye drop. They suck up the sperm, and that's him loaded up and ready to go. Now, when he goes off and finds the female, he will inject one of the palps in, and then hopefully, if she's still willing, he'll get another go, and that will increase his chances of fertilizing her. If he survives that, he will go again to another female. Now, the chances of getting that chance is fairly slim, because it's quite rough. Now, some spiders, like, they have crazy ways of reproducing. Like, the redbacks in Australia, the male will actually, like, as he approaches the female, will turn his abdomen up into her fangs and let her eat him as he's doing the act. Why he does this, we reckon that it's, well, people who've studied it reckon that it allows him the time, as he's being devoured, to make sure he's got the job done. And he even has a sphincter muscle inside in his abdomen that will close off while he's getting eaten, so he doesn't bleed out.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a spider species in North America where the male will, it's the yellow and black striped garden spider. And the male will actually inject his palp in, and as he's fertilizing, he'll die. He'll die and hang there, and he becomes a kind of a copulatory plug. He stops, he basically ensures that no one else is going to mate with her, and it turns her off the drive to mate herself. So that ensures that his genes move forward and no one else's. So there's all sorts of different
evolutionary adaptations and sacrifices.
Yeah. And again, that's basically what the male's role is.
Yeah, fascinating.
So, yeah, it really is.
So they are, like, all female spiders really are widows to an extent.
Yeah, to one degree or another, you know. And there's a massive size difference generally between male and female spiders, because the males don't have to produce the eggs, so they are that much smaller. Some of them by thousands of times smaller. Like, you know, if you're looking at Nephila, who are the giant golden orb-web spiders, you'll see. And, you know, if you're down in Sydney, if you ever get a chance to go to Australia and you're down the Botanic Gardens in Sydney, you'll see these massive, huge webs, like metres across, and you'll see the giant females sitting in there, size of your hand.
Okay.
Yeah. But the males would look like, you know, a small penny spider you'll see crawling around in your garden in Ireland. They're tiny, tiny little creatures compared to the females. So it there is a massive variation between the males and the females.
Oh, it's so interesting. But I from an evolutionary sense, I can see the benefit in it, of course. So from a conservation point of view, are spiders in trouble? And if so, what are the issues? Is it climate change? Is it pesticides? Is it what is it? What's going on?
I suppose there's going to be winners and losers, like a lot of invertebrates and animals in general, with climate change, with you know, habitat fragmentation, all that kind of stuff. In regards to conservation with spiders, it's a tough sell. It's hard to get people interested in. So it's happening a lot more. There's a lot more people taking an interest and studying them and getting in depth into them. You know, in Europe we have a few protected species of spider that aren't doing great, like some of the raft spiders, the fen raft spider, the ladybird spiders, stuff like that, have quite low numbers in certain areas in Europe where they would have been very widespread. But again, that's down to
habitat loss.
Yeah. And then you have specialist spiders like you know, diving bell spiders, and who need boggy areas, who need wetlands and marshlands. And of course we're losing them, like, en masse, so that puts them at risk. There has been some success stories. P. metallica, which is one of the Indian ornamental tarantulas, a beautiful metallic looking, hence the name. It's kind of a vivid blue arboreal tarantula, and they live in kind of trees and in a certain small area of India called Gugi. And basically the habitat they were in, which is quite unique for them, kind of just got wiped out. So they were kind of on the red list for a while, but captive breeding, like, I breed them now, so we kind of got a hold on numbers in captivity. And now there's programs to re-release them back into the wild. And the great thing about spiders is you don't have to do any kind of training. They just, spiders be spidering and they just know what to do. So that is good news. But I suppose it's one to watch. We really have to keep an eye on the rarer species, and particularly ones that need specific habitats like wetlands and, you know, and native forests and places like that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought it up, because one thing I wanted to ask you about is I'm involved in Abileek's Bog Project and Community Wetlands Forum and stuff. And on my travels, I would come across raft spiders occasionally. Mm-hmm.
Big boys. Big girls, I mean.
Big girls, yeah. Are they raft spiders I'm seeing? The big stripes down the back? And
very distinctive looking. They have that. They've kind of the go faster stripes down the side of the head. And
tell me about those.
Yeah, so they have a very unusual way of hunting. Instead of using a web, so a web is just an extension of a spider's body, really. That's what they use it for. So they, instead of having to cover a lot of ground, they can kind of sit there, and the vibrations of the web will touch off the legs, basically, of the spider and kind of send a signal to its brain, and it can pinpoint the area where the prey is and run there and have a nice snack and go back to the centre of the web or the tube they've made out of silk, whatever the species is. What the raft spiders do is they use the surface tension of the water as that same principle. So anything that lands on the water, or a fish, even a fish under the water or anything, will make a vibration, and the spider can detect where it is and hone in, like very much like a bat using sonar, really, in a way. So it's a very, very cool adaptation, and they're a wonderful looking spider. I'd love to get some out in the ponds around here, but we'll see. Fingers crossed.
It's astounding to think we have a species in Ireland that can potentially catch a live fish.
Oh, we have two. We have the diving bell spider, which is the world's only spider that literally will live a subaquatic life. So the raft spiders are basically hovercraft on the top of the water, where the diving bell spider is a submarine spider. They have a very silvery kind of fine hair on the abdomen, and they trap an air bubble, and they'll bring it down under the into the aquatic vegetation in the pond, and they'll web up a bell, like a kind of a dome shape, and they'll fill that up with air from taking trips up and down, and then they can literally sit in the web underwater, spinning out a web as the spider behind your fridge does, same thing, and just sit there, catch tadpoles, dragonfly larvae, sticklebacks.
That's fascinating. It's amazing.
And they're one of the few spiders, actually, that the males are bigger than the females, and people still don't know why, but the males are quite big compared to the females. And they have a good nip as well for an Irish species of spider. They've pretty good venom, and that's probably down to prey as well, because if you're preying on a lot of different species, and some of them would have been vertebrates, obviously, being sticklebacks and small frogs and stuff like that, you need good venom to kind of subdue them. So yeah, I find them fascinating and one to look out for. If you're ever doing pond dipping and you see a spider in there, you're like, I wonder how that happened. That potentially is one of those fantastic diving bell spiders.
Diving bell spiders. Mm-hmm. Good, yeah. Going yeah. on to Google those. That's mad. Now, you've presented me here with some show and tell.
Yeah.
And I know immediately what I'm looking at, and because I'm so alert to them because of recent media coverage. So I have three little test tubes, vials here, and they all contain false widow spiders. So tell me about those. I mean, fascinating. They're on everyone's radar at the minute.
Yeah, and that's largely down to the fantastic work done by the Venom Lab in Galway University, by Dr. Michelle Dugan and JP Dunbar, who have been studying their arrival in Ireland and their impact on native species and ourselves, obviously, since they got here. And they're here about 20 years, originally from Madeira and the Canary Islands, are now probably touching on being one of the most invasive spider species on the planet, because they're showing up everywhere. New Zealand, the States, all over Europe. So they travel very, very well. They're unusual for araneomorphs in the fact that the females can live a number of years, 5 to 6 years sometimes. And yeah, they are our first spider we can kind of say have medically significant venom, and that means if you were to get a nip off them, you could have a reaction pain, itching, necrosis on the point of the bite. And in some severe cases where people get multiple bites because it was stuck in a pajama leg or in a sock or something like that, and it's kind of biting to save its life, you can get a really bad reaction. You might have to go to the hospital. Now, that's not to freak anybody out, because the good news is they're not an aggressive species. All the bites come from them getting trapped in clothing, jackets, socks, like I said, and that's when they kind of nip people. Even if you do get nipped, chances are it will be a very, very mild, much similar in experience to getting a sting off a bee. They haven't killed anyone. They haven't, you know, really severely hurt anybody. So it's good news on that front. But it is important that this research was done, because a lot of us didn't, until it was done, until the venom was looked at by in the lab, a lot of people didn't think that there was anything to them, that they were completely, like, you know, just harmless and it was fine. But they are one to watch, and it is a very interesting thing. And the fact that they're so successful, like if you go down through Dublin at night, if you're walking down Pier Street, for example, because when I'm waiting for a bus on Pier Street, I often have a little torch with me or something, and you just have a look along the railings, and it's just false widows, false widows, false widows, all along the walls. They do so well, and they just basically take over an area. Now, the implications for our native species is pretty dire, because in lab tests, when they've been put in situ with native species of spider, the false widows tend to come out on top. They're the Mike Tyson of the spider world. They're quite feisty, and it's going to be interesting to see as they spread, and when they get out into the countryside, what are they going to do? What's their impact going to be? We've recorded them even predating on small native Irish lizards, so they are definitely one to watch, but nothing to be absolutely terrified about. It's just a very interesting case study of a species arriving on our shore and being very, very successful.
Well, it's better the devil you know than the devil you don't.
Exactly. So I think that's a very good way. And I mean, like, I often say to people as well, because like all of us travel to Europe, to Australia, to the States, and they have loads of species of Lactrodetrus, which are the true widows, and nobody bats an eyelid about, you know, going to a villa in Italy and all, or Spain or Portugal, and they have all these many more species which would be have you know, similar effects if they give you a nip. So it's nothing to worry about.
Cool. No, I definitely agree with you there. Tell me this: it's going on since I can remember, and probably long before I was ever around. But this, what I would say, is a bit of annual BS. It's almost like, you know, gulls come on the scene once a year when politicians have nothing else to talk about. It's, are spiders getting bigger?
No, absolutely not. And it is frustrating. And you kind of, like, it is a seasonal thing as well. So you get your gulls, your foxes, you get your spiders. Silverfish are starting to make an annual appearance now. And it always seems to be led by pest control people who, for some reason, I don't know why that is now, but they seem to say, oh, spiders are getting huge and they're coming into your house, and if you need to get rid of them, call this number. So it's kind of, you can see where it's coming from. I used to get a little bit annoyed about it, but I kind of look at it as an opportunity now to do a bit of PR for the spiders and a bit of kind of science communication, where you reassure people and kind of give the good selling points of spiders and what they do in our houses to relieve us of the pests that, you know, will contaminate our food, will eat our furniture. The spiders are doing all that stuff for free. They're not charging you. They're doing the pest controller's job for free in your house. That's why if you ever move house and you pull out your fridge or whatever, you'll probably find a pile of earwigs and wood lice and blue bottles and all sorts of stuff that, you know, the giant European house spider has been eating behind there. But they certainly aren't getting bigger. The disconnect people have with nature nowadays feeds into that, because spiders are always going to be around your house and your dwelling, no matter how clean you are. They just get in, and they'll, particularly in the autumn when the males are on the move, and particularly with the giant European house spider who are nearly as big as the raft spiders we were talking about. So they're quite significant. They're big old lanky fellas, and if they were to run across a newspaper, you could hear the footsteps yeah. are that big. So, and if people aren't connected to nature, they're spending all their time in an office, and they, you know, the nearest thing to get to nature is walking the dog in the park, but they don't stop to smell the roses like people like ourselves probably would. They can freak out and they'd say, oh my God, that has to be a murderous giant tarantula that came in bananas, because they just are unaware. Yeah, I suppose the annual thing I do now is just try to do a bit of PR and tell people what they are, why they're doing what they're doing, and you can kind of change people's minds that way, I think.
Definitely. I mean, people like yourself definitely are such good ambassadors for everything nature all around, but spiders, like you say, it's not an easy sell.
It's the worst. It really is. It's so, you know, and sometimes you get interviewers who would be very...
nonchalant.
Well, some of them are very interested and very fascinated by what you're telling them, and then some people are just so squeamish and turned off by them that they're just the whole way through the interview. So you're kind of trying to drag them kicking and screaming into even just a little understanding of the spiders. On the whole, it works out good, because I think if you any creature, if you kind of can just show how wonderful they are and their fascinating lifestyle that they have, even if somebody doesn't exactly want to give them a cuddle or a hug, if they can appreciate how they've been around so long and what they do and how different they are to us, I think you can just spark that little bit of interest and perhaps a little bit of relaxation in the fear.
It's funny, years ago I used to work for the RSPB, which are the bird people in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it was a conference all about membership and attracting members and retaining members. And they invited the CEO of Bug Life to talk about membership. And his opening sentence was, he's just like, screw ye. He's like, yeah, I'm trying to convince people to support spiders.
Yeah, it's
and you
very
guys
difficult.
Have the birds.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And even with the organisation, myself and Rob are leading the charge for herpetological studies and science in Ireland. And that's a hard sell as well with newts and frogs, because, you know, they're not exactly badgers and foxes. They're not so cuddly and charming. But it's a challenge, and it's good to try and to meet that. And people do warm to them after you keep banging away at it and saying how brilliant they are.
Absolutely. And just last night, raised another question. Last night, the kids were going down for a bath, and it was a giant house spider in the bath. Mm-hmm. And Claire called me, and I just went down and picked it out. But the first thing, like, I wouldn't say, like, I'm terribly comfortable picking them up, but I just grabbed it by, like, the few back legs. And I always put it out the sort of nearest mm-hmm. window. Am I cursing that spider to, like, certain doom? Or what's the best practice if you're translocating a spider?
Yeah, the best thing to do is to just do the old cup and paper trick. Put the cup over the spider and slide a bit of paper underneath it and pop it out into the garden.
And it's not going to die immediately
out
in the garden.
No, I mean, like, they're well adapted to living here. The reason why they use the houses is the same reason we do, because it's nice and comfy and warm. But they'll still get by in your shed or in you know, an old... rotten tree, which is where they would be naturally, you know. So and at this time of year, it's a male spider you'd be pulling out, so he's just going to go off on the wander looking for a romance. So romance and certain doom, but you know, that's the most ethical way of dealing with it. You have to kind of appreciate that having this fear of spiders, snakes, scorpions and all is genetic, as much as it is learned. So you have those two factors. So if your mom is terrified of spiders and you're grown up as a kid and she's screaming the house down, that's going to have an effect on you, obviously. But then again, another one it's inbred into is our ancestors that survived, that didn't pick up the scorpions or the spiders. They survived because they had a healthy fear of these animals. So
yeah, there's an ancient genetic warning there.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, you have to understand that in people and appreciate that it's, you know, it's part of our psyche and it just is what it is. But the most important thing I try to get over to people is, particularly in Ireland and even in the UK, we're so fortunate that we don't have particularly nasty spiders over here. We're not, you don't have funnel webs like they have in Sydney and crazy creatures coming, you know, into your garden that can give you a nip, like, you know, a significant nip. So we're very lucky over here that we have quite charming and beautiful and relatively safe spiders around our houses and our gardens.
Speaking of which, some of the jumping spiders are cool little dudes.
And
you were tweeting about one the other night, and I was just looking at them. They're just so, like, they're just mad looking. But they're a bit, like, I find them slightly uncomfortable, because you're like, is he about to sort of, like, jump at me at any point?
Yeah.
But tell me about the adaptation to jump. Is it locomotion? Is it predator defense? Is it to prey on other species? What is the adaptation?
So not all spiders make webs. Like we were talking about the tarantulas earlier on. So when spiders first evolved, they would have been burrowing creatures and creatures that lived on the ground. So the more highly evolved spiders are the ones, the uraniomorphs, that like the garden cross spider that you'd see in your garden in the big, beautiful orb webs that mist up lovely on a misty morning. They're very well highly evolved compared to other species of spiders that haven't developed that web and system. The jumping spiders are a different case altogether. Jumping spiders are maybe like the chimpanzees of the spider world. Some of them, like Portia, which is a very small Australian species of jumping spider, kind of disguised itself like lynching, kind of almost. And they've been shown to kind of have problem solving abilities. So they would predate on other spiders as well as flies and bugs, but they'll strum on a spider's web to draw it out, go up onto a branch above it. So then they'll kind of, in their own weird way, they'll be like, right, if I do this, she's going to come out to the web, and then if I run up and jump on her back, I'm not going to get bitten and I can safely buy her. I mean, that's fascinating for such a small little creature. And you can see even the jumping spiders, they're almost looking at you trying to figure you out, you know. They have that kind of, there really does seem to be something going on.
It's like, I think it's called the theory of mind, where if something's intelligent enough to realise someone else might have some other counter sort of ideas that would, you know, would run against them. So it's
fascinating, like, to see problem solving in such a small little creature. So and the jumping spiders, they'll basically run along leaves, and they're mainly arboreal, so they'll be up in trees, and they trail silk, but it's more like a bungee cord if they miss a jump, if they miscalculate a jump, which rarely happens. And they use the back legs to kind of flick themselves forward to really cover some distance. And
have we Manny or Annie in Ireland?
Oh, we have, yeah. We've got, the most common one would be the zebra jumping spider. You'll see kind of it's named that because it looks like a tiny little zebra, white and black stripes. And it's fascinating to watch them, because if you do see one and you watch it going along, they'll be looking around at everything from fruit flies to you know, springtails, all those kind of smaller little creatures, and figuring them out. And you can see how the jumping spider is working out, calculating the distance to jump. And they're very active hunters compared to the sedentary lives that the spiders who build webs have. So I find them very, very charming. I think they're amazing little creatures. And, you know, even keeping some of the bigger species of jumping spiders, some of them can be as big as your thumbnail. But again, they're araneomorphs, so they only live a year. They literally have a yearly cycle. So you kind of get attached to them and then they're gone. You get attached to them over the summer, and then by the winter they're finished their life cycle. But a fascinating little animal. Want to look out for if you're around the garden. You'll spot them. People sometimes confuse them with crab spiders. Crab spiders will be the ones, the brightly, usually white. You'll see them on flowers in your garden because they know the pollinators are coming down to do their work. And the crab spider has the two front legs are extremely long, and that's where they get the name from, because they kind of look like flattened crab claws. But they'll just sit there and wait for Mr. Bumblebee to come along. And that's another good way of spotting them, because if you're walking along, you just see a bee or a butterfly kind of dangling out of a plant for a prolonged amount of time, you're like, oh, I wonder what's happening there. And then if you just get in closer, then you'll see the spider that's just feeding away on them. They're very similar looking to the jumping spiders, but they have a sedentary kind of a life compared to the jumping spiders, which are constantly on the go, constantly actively hunting.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to ask you. So as a bird person, I know how well a lot of species of birds do with spiders. Myself and Niall are going to talk about tree creepers, for example, as our bird of the week, spider, because they just mill every little spider up and down the tree. Yeah. And
I have a couple on the trees behind me.
It's lovely. It's a perfect place for tree creepers. So, worldwide, are there any spiders who prey on birds?
Yeah, so, I mean, like, a lot of the tarantulas would have been called bird eaters back in the day. Now, that was because when they were doing the initial kind of scientific trips out, Darwin and the boys going off in the boats, they had to get sponsorship. So they had to come back with very elaborate tales of these creatures. And when you bring back a Goliath bird eater, which is the biggest species of spider in the world, it's about the size of a dinner plate, monstrous creatures, they would call them bird eaters to try and drill up some interest. And of course then they'd be, oh my god, here's some more money, more trips. Now, Goliath bird eaters could easily eat a bird, but they live in a burrow 3 or 4 foot underground, so they're more likely to be eating worms and lizards and rodents and then eating birds. Now, Nephila, the golden orb web spider that I was talking about earlier on, their web is so strong and so sticky and entangling that they have been recorded on numerous occasions eating birds, eating small sparrows and whatnot. So they're very well capable of entangling and munching on a bird for a long time. And, you know, pink-toed tarantulas have been recorded eating birds as well. A lot of the arboreal species of tarantula have pretty good funky venom for vertebrates. So when you're a bird up in a tree, like, if a bird is going up and down the bark, the trunk of a tree, rooting around the bark, and there's a big Indian ornamental spider there, he'll come out and take them, no problem. So it wouldn't be like their primary source of food, but definitely on the menu from time to time.
That's fascinating. That is fascinating. I'm going to have to Google some of these species.
Yeah,
I just want to see them. Colleague, that's it. I mean, that's fascinating. There's a lot to take in there. I really enjoyed that. And I hope yourself that you come back and maybe talk about amphibians with us. And
I'd absolutely love to, yeah. We might do it in the spring when it's...
Good timing.
It's good timing, yeah. We can even have a look in the garden and see who's...
That's what we'll do. We'll do it on the hoof and we'll look at the ponds.
That'd
that's
be brilliant, deadly. Yeah.
Colleague, thanks again.
You're very welcome.
Really fascinating stuff. There's a man who really loves the subject and knows all about it. He got me really enthused about spiders myself. It was interesting hearing there about the noble false widow spiders, particularly because in the last few years I've seen increasing numbers in my own house here in County Wicklow. And they freak me out to begin with, and I've kind of got used to them, but they really are all over the place, much more common than people realise. And it got me kind of into wanting to know more about spiders. So lovely to hear him there. And hopefully more of our listeners will develop an interest in spiders too. They're not really that scary.
No, they're not. I suppose we're not in the scary part of the world for spiders, and most of our birds look after them for us. So speaking of which, our bird of the week is a bit of a spider chomper, and it's a beautiful wee bird, and it's one of these ones that I would say goes undetected a lot of the time for people, and it's the tree creeper.
Tree creeper, wonderful little bird. I still vividly remember the very first time I ever saw one as a kid. I was out walking in a park with my dad and saw this movement on the bark of a tree, a really craggy, deep-barked tree. And I, first of all, thought it was a little mouse that was scurrying up the tree. And then I looked closer and realised it was a bird. And then it flew across to the next tree. And I realised, even at that young age, I saw the way it had this strategy of, rather than flying away from me, it would back around to the other side of the tree. This is a bird that lives pretty much its whole life on the vertical plane. It goes up tree trunks, never down them, always just up the tree trunks, working its way around the bark. Their whole lives revolve around bark. They even look like bark, which is one of the reasons they're so hard to find.
Yeah, no, they're amazing. And, like, yeah, it's mad to think that their ecosystem could be just 5 or 6 mature trees in, like, wherever, your back garden, the Phoenix Park, wherever, and they never move from there. And they find enough sustenance, enough spiders in the cracks and the crevices of the bark. And they've got this lovely little needle-shaped bill or beak, like this almost like a miniature wader bill. It's downward, sort of slight downward curve on it. And then they've got this lovely white belly as well, and if you're lucky enough to see it. And the funny thing is they'll fly to the bottom of the tree and work their way back up all the time. And And I remember I've told that story or given that fact that so many walks. And I remember once in the Phoenix Park doing a walk for the OPW there at the visitor centre. And I said they always fly to the bottom of the tree and they always walk upwards. And this guy, this tree keeper decided to make a liar out of me, and he sort of started moonwalking back down the tree. And it's very annoying, but he did. And the other thing is, I've done a few nocturnal walks in the Phoenix Park as well. And you can often actually in the Scots Pine, you can find them roosting in little cracks and crevices. And sometimes they have a little kind of trail of poo where they're at their regular roost, where it's kind of a giveaway from them, and you see them hunched up in a nice little crevice. And I just think they're the smartest little things ever. And the other thing, the best way of detecting them maybe is if you can tune in to their call, which is a very, very high pitch. It's not the easiest thing to detect, but let's pause for a second and we'll have a listen.
That call there, that's often the indication when I'm walking through a woodland, maybe leading a bird watching group or something like that, all of a sudden it'll just stop and everyone wonders, what's he heard? Why is he broken off mid-conversation? And it's because of that sound. And it's actually beyond the hearing range of some people. As we get older, we lose the higher frequencies of the hearing, of that register when we're hearing. And so some people can't hear it at all. But that's a sign that there's a tree cover nearby. And if you look around, it can often be possible to detect where it's likely to be, because it wants to be in those mature trees with a really craggy bark. It's not going to be down on the ground. It's not going to be out in the leaves. It's going to be on the bark or some of the thicker branches perhaps, and as you said, working its way upwards. It used to be the only bird in Ireland we had that would work its way up a tree trunk, but obviously in recent years Ireland has been colonised by the great spotted woodpecker, which does the same thing. But famously in Ireland we don't have nuthatches, which are a group of birds that are related to tree creepers that look quite different. They also live on tree trunks. The Eurasian nuthatch is a very common bird across the water in Britain, but completely absent from Ireland. But they work their way both up and down the tree trunks, which tree creepers and woodpeckers don't do. Tree creepers are very interesting. There's half a dozen or so different species of them around the world, including two in Europe, our common tree creepers we call it, and then the short-toed tree creeper in parts of the continent. But the thing is, all those species, they look almost identical. They have a very similar almost plumage, identical body shape, and so obviously it's an evolutionary strategy that works. They've got their own niche, they've sort of locked that down. Other birds aren't doing the same thing, and it seems to work perfectly for them.
Definitely. I would say you pointed out earlier on that your first thoughts were initially that it was a mouse. And I would say exactly that. If you think you see a mouse running up a tree, it's a tree creeper. And they're lovely kind of gingery hazel colour on top, and then that big white belly and that little sort of narrow and beady eyes. There's just something very, very appealing about them. And if you see them, I think you'll be hooked. It's one of those species. You said there as well about they're being very difficult to detect. It's out of the hearing range of or frequency for many people. Another bird that we've had previously as a species or bird of the week is the goldcrest. And very similar niche in that they're arboreal and they depend on trees and woodlands and stuff. But they also have high-pitched sort of calls and it can be difficult to hear. So obviously it's some sort of adaptation to carry amongst trees and heavily sort of dense tree-lined areas. It's designed for other birds to hear, not for us.
Absolutely. They're communicating to each other. It could be part of courtship. It could be warning of danger. And one of the theories is that the higher pitched a sound is, the harder it is for a predator to pinpoint it and to find out exactly where it is. So if it's a low-pitched sound, it's much easier to find out exactly where it's coming from. Higher pitched, it's harder to find. So when they're calling in the trees and they're being quite loud, they want to avoid things like sparrowhawks. They want to make sure that they're nice and safe and secure. And their chicks are safe as well. So that's how they live. And that's what they do. Really fascinating little birds. One of the things I love to see about them too, if you watch them closely when they're going up a tree trunk, you'll see that they have a rather unusual tail, and they use that as part of the motion of going up the tree. They have these stiffened tail feathers, the end in little points, and they use that like a prop to sort of prop themselves against the tree. So they can lean back with their feet and the tail tip anchors them and it's stiffened. A normal bird tail would bend and break perhaps under that pressure. Not that the tree creeper weighs very much, but even so, that could happen. But they have stiffened tail feathers just like a woodpecker does, helping them sort of almost halfway bounce up the tree using that as a support.
I wonder, I know like people get very funny about ivy, and we're always saying don't touch the ivy, it's so important and it doesn't choke trees like people think and all that sort of stuff. I wonder, is it a bit of a challenge for tree creepers though?
I suppose it would be, yes, because they won't go through that. They have no interest in going into dense vegetation at all. So when ivy is all around a tree trunk, that certainly would limit the availability there for them. However, of course, it has great benefits for lots of other species. As we've discussed, many species will nest in there. Ivy berries are a real lifeline for birds like blackcaps as well. It could be the real difference between life and death to them at certain times of year. So definitely it's a plant to be encouraged. But again, it's all about balance. Certainly the tree creepers don't like it so much. I remember vividly as well in my mother's garden a few years ago when we had really, really cold winter. I was flabbergasted to see a tree tree creeper actually coming to the peanut feeder.
Wow.
I'd never seen that ever happen before. And I got my binoculars out and had a look. And the thing was, it was actually quite tragic watching it. It didn't know the peanuts were food. What the poor thing was trying to do was probe in between the nuts to find insects that might be sheltering in there. So it didn't know there was food right in front of it. It was looking for insects.
God, poor little devil. And those winters were so hard. It was crazy. They were doing all sorts of things totally off the norm. I would say, and it's a good time. Sometimes we introduce species that have just gone south, or we get the timing wrong. But the tree creepers are sort of a... They're always around, and winter's a good time because there's less leaves on the trees, and they're always active. They have to remain active, and there's always spiders and bits and bobs around the tree. So it is a good time to go look for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find them any time of year, but as you said, no leaves on the trees makes it a lot easier. So keep an eye out for the little movement up the tree. Listen for that high-pitched sound if you can as well that we played earlier. And bear in mind, of course, that this is a species that relies on native invertebrates, essentially. They eat spiders, they eat other small insects, anything that might shelter in that bark. So anything we can do that will encourage as many of those native creepy crawlies as possible, including the spiders, is certainly to be welcomed, and the tree creepers will certainly benefit from that.
Excellent, excellent. So I think that's it. No more to say about it. I'm looking forward to the next episode. And yeah, we'll be back real soon. I hope you've enjoyed that one and the interview with Collie. We're thankful to him for his contribution, and I'm sure we'll have him back because he's got so much more to talk about.
Thanks everyone for listening. And just as we always say, if you're interested enough to listen to us talk about birds and other nature for this length of time, we'd love you to join Birdwatch Ireland, because as a charity, it makes an enormous difference for us. It's not just about the birds, it's about birds and biodiversity. So by doing that, you'd really help us. Please go to birdwatchireland.ie for all the details there. And just to conclude again by saying, the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, and it's edited by Kieran O'Connor.